So, let's chant Mani Padme Hum a little bit, then go into some silent meditation. Again, with the silent meditation, you can either come back to the breath if you want, or you can think a little bit of what you heard in the previous teaching about precious human life and the meaning of life, or you can think some more about the eight worldly concerns. Do some inner examination about these eight, because, and notice how they operate in your life, because there's quite a bit actually to think about there. And then after that, we'll have the talk. When we're chanting the mantra, it's good to imagine Chenrezig or Kuan Yin in this space in front of you, and much light radiating from Kuan Yin, Chenrezig, and that light flows into you. It flows into all the sentient beings that you imagine are around you. And it purifies our negative karma and brings with the realizations of wisdom and compassion. So thinking like that, visualizing like that while chanting the mantra, really changes our mind. Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme Hum. 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 Om Mani Padme Hum, Om Mani Padme. Recall your motivation to learn and practice the Dharma, to transform your own mind, in order to become a fully awakened Buddha, so that you can be of the most effective benefit to all living beings. Okay, so we talked this morning, listed the three motivations, and that each motivation had meditations you did prior to it in order to cultivate that motivation, and meditations you did afterwards in order to actualize that motivation, to attain its results. So we've been talking about the first level of motivation, that of gaining a good rebirth. And so in order to generate that motivation, we think of our precious human life, how meaningful it is, how difficult it is to attain. And then we contemplate the eight worldly concerns and reflect that we have this wonderful life that's so meaningful that we work so hard to get, but we spend an awful lot of it in distraction. And our distractions center on these eight worldly concerns. Okay? And if we look at our lives, we spend a lot of time with these eight worldly concerns. You know, when you wake up in the morning, what's the first thought? Is it, I want to become a Buddha for the sake of sentient beings? Or is it, where's my coffee? Yeah. During the day as we're going about our activities, are we thinking, you know, how can I progress along the path? Or are we thinking, how can I get what I want? Okay? So here's, you know, the Dharma path is right there. But it's actually sometimes very difficult to practice it because these eight worldly concerns get in the way. So reflecting on impermanence, that everything about these eight changes constantly, we come to see that they're not reliable. We can't trust them. Our reputation comes and our reputation goes. People approve of us, and then they disapprove of us. And then they approve of us again, and then they disapprove. We get money, and then we lose money. We have nice food, and we have awful food. Yeah, we have nice things to see, and then there's awful things to see. Yeah, so all the time with these eight, yeah, we're always going between having the part that we want and being attached to it, and then getting the part of it that we don't want and having aversion. So we spend a lot of our lives in what one of my teachers used to call being an emotional yo-yo. Yeah, you know the yo-yo, the little toy? Down, up, down. I like this, I don't like that. Give me this, get me away from that. The yo-yo, the emotional yo-yo, goes up and down. Yeah? So we become like emotional yo-yos depending upon what situation we're in, what object we're with, what person we're with, or what we think about all these things. Yeah? So emotionally, we're not very stable, are we? Yeah, when our friends see us, they're not sure who we're going to be that day. Are we going to be us who's in a bad mood because somebody in our family did something we didn't like? Or are they going to get us who's in a good mood because, gee, somebody praised me, I feel good today? You know? We're like not kind of even, predictable, equanimous. We're like that. Are you? Are you an emotional yo-yo? Are you? Well, there's a few people who are honest. The rest of you, I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So reflecting on impermanence helps us to detach a little bit from all these worldly concerns and not get so involved in them, yeah? Not inflate their importance. Because right now, the importance of approval, reputation, all these things is way inflated. You know, we think they're crucially important. Yet, who else besides us worries about our reputation? There's over 7 billion human beings on this planet. And who obsesses about my reputation? One person. Me. Nobody. Nobody else cares about my reputation. They may say this, they may see that, but they're actually too busy thinking about their own reputation to be much concerned whether I have a good one or a bad one. Yeah? I have people praise me and appreciate me and tell me they love me, and then people say, I hate your guts. Yeah, who cares about that? Out of 7 billion human beings. Yeah? Who cares about whether other people approve of me or not? Just me. Other people really don't care that much. They may approve of me or disapprove of me, but they're not going to worry about whether I have approval and appreciation and love. Only me, I focus on, oh, I'm not appreciated enough. I don't have enough love. Anybody here have enough love? Anybody? Couldn't you use a little bit more love? How about appreciation? Do you have enough appreciation? Are you overflowing with people's appreciation? Or would you like some more? Yeah, some more would be nice, huh? Because we do so much for other sentient beings, and they don't appreciate what we do for them, do they? Yeah, we work so hard. We really try and be nice to them. We really try and help them. And then they don't even say thank you. Oh, how rude. How awful. Yeah? After me, sweet, wonderful, caring me, go out of my way to be kind to somebody, and then they repay that. Yeah? Well, that's what we all feel, huh? We don't get nearly as much appreciation as we deserve. Yeah. Do you worry about your friend if they have enough appreciation and love? I don't think so. Yeah. Do you obsess? Oh, my friend doesn't have enough appreciation. No, you don't meditate on that. You meditate on, I'm not appreciated. So we're a little bit self-concerned, don't you think? A little bit self-preoccupied. And maybe even a lot self-preoccupied. Maybe overwhelmingly self-preoccupied. Maybe having blinders so that all we see is ourself. When we think, you know, that all the praise, reputation, money, social status, all these things come, come, go, go. And we can't control it, can we? We all want happiness, and we can't control the external world to make it so that we have everything we want. Yeah? So that's because the only thing, you know, if we really want happiness, is to change what's inside here. Trying to change everybody else, we're never going to succeed. So we have to change here, okay? And to do that, we have to release this obsession about ourselves and all this attachment, all this anger regarding the happiness of this life, because it really drives us crazy. So when we contemplate that sometime we're going to die, that our death is definitely certain, but we don't know when it's going to happen. Yeah, it could come tonight, tomorrow. It could come after many years. We don't know. Because people die at all sorts of ages. They don't just die when they're old. And they die in all sorts of situations. We just heard a story from a friend of ours about his friend, somebody who was a very good friend. And the friend's girlfriend had just passed her medical admission exams. So they went out to celebrate. They were both in their 20s, early mid-20s. So they went out to celebrate that she passed her exams. So somehow, I don't know how, they were dancing on a rooftop. I guess somebody had a party or whatever on a rooftop, flat roof. And the boy fell off and died. 25 years old, kaboom. After, you know, in the process of celebrating his girlfriend's success, that was the end of his life, finished. Yeah, and we always think these kind of things won't happen to me. And I'm sure that boy thought that would never happen to him. My dad died because he choked on some food at his own birthday party. Can you imagine that? At your birthday party with the people you love, you choke on some food, boom, finished. Yeah. So we don't know when death is going to come. And when we die, yeah, our family and friends don't come with us. They all stay here. Yeah? Do any of them come with you? Even if they're, when you're dying, they're holding your hand saying, please don't die, I love you so much. Can they stop themselves from dying? Can you go with them? Yeah? So when we die, our friends and family stay here. We go on alone. Our money and possessions stay here. We go on without them. And even our body that we're always trying to make sure is comfortable, it abandons us at the time of death too. The only thing that goes with us at the time of death is the karma we've created. The mental habits that we've put in our mind. Everything else here, especially everything that has to do with the eight worldly concerns, none of it comes with. Yeah? Doesn't matter you're famous or not famous. After you die, yeah, finished. Yeah? We all want to have a good reputation after we die, but we're not even here to enjoy it. Yeah? It's ridiculous being attached to it, isn't it? Okay, so thinking about our own mortality helps us set our priorities in life very clearly. We start to ask ourselves, you know, seeing that I'm going to die, is worrying about money so important? Yeah, seeing I'm going to die and leave all my money here, is worrying about it so important? Is working overtime so I can get more money so important? Did you ever hear of anybody on their deathbed having the regret of, I should have worked more overtime? Nobody regrets that. What kind of things do people regret at the time of death? They regret their meanness to other people. Yeah. They regret what they did under the influence of anger. They regret what they did under the influence of greed and craving. Yeah. But nobody regrets not having worked more. Okay, so, you know, when we really think about this, then it's extremely helpful to the mind to settle the mind down and help us focus on what's important in our life. Yeah, very, very helpful for that way. And in that process of focusing on what's important in our life, yeah, we realize that creating virtue, doing what is wholesome, so that we have the karmic seeds in our mind stream to have a good rebirth, we realize that that's really important. And we also realize that purifying any destructive actions we've done is important, and abandoning our tendency to do any further destructive actions is very important. Okay? So we really see the importance of ethical conduct. Yeah, so sometimes we hear ethical conduct, morality, and we have the idea that it's being forced on us by somebody else. Yeah, somebody else made the rules and we have to adhere to them. It's not like that. Okay? I think when we really look in our minds, we can often discriminate, yeah, what is valuable and what isn't, because we can tell what did we do with a kind motivation and what did we do with a rotten one. In case we can't tell that so well, the Buddha talked about 10 actions to try and avoid and 10 actions to try and do. Okay. And so this comes into the whole teaching of karma and its effects. Okay. Before I get into that, when we think about our death and we think about what's important, we also and we see that what's important is preparing for our next life. We also see that we don't really know what to do to prepare for our next life. That we may have some idea of ethical conduct, but it's not a very clear one. Yeah. We realize that, wait a minute, I've been spending a lot of my time on the 8 worldly concerns, and that's meaningless. But what do I do instead? If I stop playing video games, what do I do with my time? Okay? So we realize that we need some help. And especially if, you know, we've done a lot of destructive actions and we see that we very well could be born in an unfortunate rebirth, you know, due to our own destructive actions, then we really see, wow, I need some help. I need some guidance. And so here's where the topic of refuge comes in. Yeah, where we turn to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha for spiritual direction. Yeah, so that we can learn what is constructive, what should we practice, what is destructive, what should we abandon? Yeah. So we start out on that level, yeah, just thinking about our next life and seek refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to learn about what to practice and what abandon to actualize so that we can attain a good life. So then we have to know what the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha mean and what taking refuge in them means. So that's the first chapter that you have in your outline. Okay, so it's in your book, the chapter from Buddhism, One Teacher, Many Traditions. That chapter is in your booklet. It should be after the meditation on the Buddha and after the food offering prayer. So mark that place, because this evening, after meditation, there's a period of study, and it's good if you read this, yeah, and start to read this chapter about refuge, because we need to understand what is the Buddha, what is the Dharma, what is the Sangha. Okay, did you find the place in your book? Somebody want to say what page it's on? The people who haven't found it? Okay? Yeah. So mark it, and in your free time this evening and after meditation, start reading it. Okay? There's a very nice analogy that shows how the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha can help us. Okay? But first, we have to understand a little bit what they are. So we say that the Dharma is the actual refuge, because here the Dharma means the true cessation and true path. Those are the last two of the Four Noble Truths. That when we actualize those in our mind, then we are protected from dukkha. And one meaning of the Sanskrit word dharma is to hold back, to protect. So the true cessation and true path, when we actualize them in our own mind, they hold us back from all unsatisfactory experiences in cyclic existence. Okay? So the Dharma is the actual refuge. The Buddha is the one who teaches us the Dharma. And he teaches us the Dharma from his own experience. So the Buddha did not create the Dharma. The Buddha didn't create anything. The Buddha only described the path that he himself followed. Okay? And then the Sangha are those individuals who have realized the nature of reality directly, with non-conceptually, and so they're on their way to arhatship, on their way to Buddhahood. And so because they know the nature of ultimate reality directly, they also are reliable and can guide us. Okay, so in this analogy, the Dharma is the real refuge, the Buddha is the teacher, yeah, the Sangha is the one who are the ones who put the teachings into practice and have some level of realization. Okay. There's another analogy for how to relate to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and this involves recognizing that we're like sick people, okay? We're sick in the sense that we wander up and down here and there in cyclic existence without any foreseeable end. Yeah, so we're born and we die, and we're born and we die, and in the middle, we have all sorts of problems. So we're sick in that way, okay? So we go to the Buddha, who is like a doctor. And a good doctor diagnoses the illness and prescribes medicine. So, according to the analogy, the Buddha diagnoses our illness of constantly recurring rebirth in cyclic existence. And he says that the cause of it is ignorance, anger, and attachment. Specifically, the ignorance that misapprehends how things exist. The Buddha then, like a doctor, prescribes the medicine. So the medicine corresponds to which of these three levels of practitioners we are. Okay? The medicine for somebody who seeks a good rebirth is to follow the teachings on karma and its effects, to abandon destructive actions, purify the ones already created, create new constructive actions. The prescription for the person who aspires for liberation, the second level of motivation, is to practice the three higher trainings. The higher trainings in ethical conduct, in concentration, and in wisdom. The prescription for the person who is the advanced level practitioner is to practice the six paramis, or you could say the 10 paramis, because you can condense them all into six. Okay? So these are the bodhisattva practices. That's what we're recommended to practice. Okay? So according to how deep we are in samsara, what exact kind of illness we have, the Buddha will describe the different levels of medicine, the different levels of practices that we should do. Okay. Now, when you go to the doctor and you get the prescription, that in itself isn't good enough. You have to go to the pharmacy and fill the prescription. And after you fill the prescription, you can't just take the pills and put them down on your bedside and worship them. Because worshiping your pills is not going to heal the disease. And ignoring the pills also isn't going to heal the disease. And eating chocolate instead, while we may think it's going to heal our disease, won't. Okay? So this is like we get the teachings from the Buddha, then we have to put them into practice. If we just take the texts and worship them, we're not going to get out of cyclic existence or get a good rebirth. Yeah. If we get distracted and lazy and don't practice, again, we won't get well. If we practice some other path, we also won't get well. Okay? So the sick person needs to take the medicine. Now sometimes, yeah, we have the medicine and it's right there. But then we go, I forgot. Is it two blue pills in the morning, three pink pills at lunch, and one green pill at night? Or is it three green pills in the morning, four red pills at lunch, and five blue pills in the evening? I forget which one it is. I got confused. Okay? So similarly, in our Dharma practice, we hear the teachings, we read books, but sometimes we sit down to practice and we can't remember exactly what we're supposed to do. Or we can't remember exactly how to do it. So this is where the Sangha comes in. The Sangha is like the nurse. The nurse comes along and says, no, it's three blue pills in the morning, two pink pills at lunch, and one green pill in the evening. And the Sangha is really helpful. They take the pills and pound them, scrunch them up, mix them with applesauce, and go open wide, zoom, just like our parents did when they were trying to get us to take medicine when we were little kids. Okay, so the Sangha helps us take the medicine. Yeah. So that's another way in which to think about the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha and how to relate to them. Yeah. But we'll get into more depth about this tomorrow when we discuss the Sangha. Okay, so when we discuss the three jewels, I mean. Okay, so then, you know, having taken refuge, then the three jewels, what they tell us to do is to observe the law of cause and effect, karma. Okay, in other words, to clean up our lives. Or in shorthand, I call it stop being a jerk. Okay, because when we live in unethical ways, we really are a jerk. today, aren't we? When we lie and we take things that haven't been given to us and we talk behind people's back and we, you know, scold them with anger and ridicule them and, you know, sleep around with other people's husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends. Yeah, we create a mess. So that's being a jerk, isn't it? So, as our parents always told us, don't be a jerk. Yeah. Now, we're going to find out the real meaning of don't be a jerk. Yeah. So in other words, to stop acting unethically, to abandon the 10 negative actions. So the 10, in short, 3 physical ones, killing, stealing, and unwise and unkind sexual behavior. 4 verbal ones, creating disharmony with our speech, harsh words, lying, creating disharmony, harsh words, and then idle talk. And then 3 mental ones, coveting other people's possessions, malicious thoughts about them, and then wrong and distorted views. Okay, so to abandon these and to purify whatever ones we've done and then to create their opposites. Okay, so simply abandoning negative actions already is a virtuous action, and doing the opposites also, like protecting life, telling the truth, things like this. They're also virtuous actions. Okay, so there we have the initial level, initial capacity. Yeah, the motivation is to attain a future life, a fortunate future life. The way to do it is to generate that motivation, meditate on precious human life, abandoning the 8 worldly concerns, death and impermanence, and the possibility of having an unfortunate rebirth. Then once we generate that motivation, then we practice taking refuge and we practice observing the law of karma and its effects. Okay? Got it? Make some sense? Is that hanging together for you? Okay. The second level motivation is to be free of all cyclic existence, to attain liberation, to become an arhat. The way we cultivate that motivation is especially by reflecting on the first 2 of the 4 Noble Truths, thinking about the dukkha, or unsatisfactory conditions of being in cyclic existence, and thinking about their origin, the mental afflictions that are rooted in ignorance, and the polluted karma or polluted actions that we create motivated by the ignorance and the mental afflictions. Okay? So when we think about those very deeply, then we say, I've had enough of samsara. Getting a good rebirth, I need one in order to practice to attain liberation or full awakening. Yeah, so a good rebirth is a temporary goal, but it's nothing to hold on to with attachment because it too is transient and comes, comes, goes, goes. So I'm really tired of being on this merry-go-round of cyclic existence, where I have a good birth and a bad birth and a good birth and a bad birth and a good birth and a bad birth and on and on and on and on, beginninglessly. And it'll be endlessly unless we practice the path. So when we generate that motivation of renunciation of cyclic existence and the determination to be free and to attain liberation, then to actually fulfill and actualize that motivation, we have to really practice the last two of the Four Noble Truths, you know, especially practicing the three higher trainings, ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom, so that we can attain the true cessations, the cessations of dukkha and its causes, okay? So that we can attain nirvana. So, you know, the ultimate true cessation, liberation, nirvana, these all mean the same thing. The deathless state, the peaceful, yeah, these are all terms referring to nirvana. Okay, so for the middle person, the motivation, yeah, is to be free of cyclic existence. Now, some people think that this kind of renunciation of cyclic existence, they get afraid of it, like, oh, if I renounce cyclic existence, I have to give up everything I like. That's incorrect. Yeah, renunciation doesn't mean giving up everything we like. It means giving up suffering and the causes of suffering. It means giving up dukkha and what makes us, you know, miserable. Okay? So don't think of renunciation as, oh God, I can't do this and I can't do that and I can't do the other thing. No, renunciation is saying, okay, all these useless actions that keep me bound in cyclic existence, all these afflicted mental states that make me miserable, I'm renouncing those and I'm developing the determination to be free from them and to attain the state of liberation and nirvana. And to do that, I need ethical conduct as the foundation. Then I need to learn to concentrate my mind. But concentration alone isn't sufficient because we can always be born in the upper realms. There's certain levels in samsara where people are born because they have deep states of concentration, but they're still in cyclic existence because the person hasn't generated wisdom. So concentration alone isn't sufficient. Yeah, we need the wisdom that knows the ultimate nature. Okay, so those three higher trainings. So that's the thing for the middle level. Okay, are you with me? Hello. Yeah. I'm hoping you can remember all this because it's really important. Yeah. Then, for the advanced level practitioner, okay, that's the person that says, well, upper rebirth is good, but it's not an end to itself. Liberation is also good, but if I get liberated by myself alone, what happens to everybody else? Do I just say, bye-bye? I'm practicing to get liberated. Good luck, everybody. I hope you get out of samsara. But I'm focusing on my own practice, my own liberation. Ciao. Bye-bye. Au revoir. Adios. Okay? No, you know, we can't do that because other living beings have been kind to us. Yeah. How can we walk out on other living beings? Yeah. So, if you know, if you think of the people that you care about most, can you walk out on them and say, I'm going for liberation, good luck? If you really care about them, you can't leave them drowning in samsara here. You have to do something. Okay? So the person with the aspiration for full awakening, yeah, has meditated on love, compassion, and they've generated bodhicitta. They have that motivation of bodhicitta. There's two methods for generating bodhicitta. Yeah. One is called the seven-point instruction of cause and effect, and the other is called equalizing and exchanging self with others. Okay. So was chapter 12 put in the book? Yeah, it was. Okay. So, and chapter 11 was too. So chapter 11 deals with the four immeasurables, the practices of love, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And then chapter 12 deals with how to generate that aspiration for full awakening, which is called the bodhicitta. It's sometimes translated as the altruistic intention, the spirit of enlightenment, the awakening mind. I just prefer the Sanskrit term bodhicitta. It's easier. So bodhicitta, when we've thought about the kindness of others, we've seen others as lovable, we've developed compassion for them, and we want to benefit them, then we have to stop and say, okay, I see others suffering, I see their kindness, I want to be a benefit, but I can't even get myself out of cyclic existence at this point. So how can I really help others to get out? How can I really benefit others? Yeah. Have you ever, like, really wanted to help somebody and not known what in the world to do? Yeah. You've had that real strong wish to be a benefit, but like, what do I do? Or sometimes we can see somebody needs help. We have a little bit of compassion, but we hold back, because if I get involved, it may bring problems for me. So our first thought is, you know, yeah, others suffering, I care about it, but actually I'm more important. I don't want to get involved in this mess. You know, and sometimes we don't know what to do. And sometimes we do something and it doesn't work. And it creates a bigger mess than before. So when we look and see our own limitations like this, then that's when we develop the aspiration for full awakening. Because we say, who is truly capable of being of the utmost benefit to other living beings? Who really has the wisdom, the compassion, the power to do that? And the only one is the Buddhas. Yeah, only the Buddhas have completely abandoned all the defilements whatsoever and actualize their own good qualities limitlessly. Even the Arhats haven't done that. So we develop that the motivation of bodhicitta, and at that moment we become a bodhisattva. Okay, so bodhisattva is somebody who is aspiring to become Buddha for the benefit of all beings. So you'll notice that at the beginning of all of our sessions, we always cultivate this bodhicitta in one way or another. So even though our bodhicitta is fabricated, it's a little bit made up right now, still, by practicing generating it again and again, eventually it will become a habit. Yeah, and we'll automatically think like that. Okay, and so the motivation for that third level being is the bodhicitta, wanting to attain full awakening for the benefit of all beings. The way to generate it is either the seven points of cause and effect, or the other method, equalizing and exchanging self and others. Once we generate that motivation, then to actualize it and actually become a Buddha, then we practice the 10 paramitas. Okay? We also do another practice that's called the 4 ways of gathering disciples. And then some people may also enter the Vajrayana at that point. Okay? So here, remember, we started all of this because I said that often we hear many different kinds of teachings, but we don't know where they fit in the path. Yeah. So if you really study even this brief overview of the 3 levels of motivation, yeah, what is done to cultivate them, and then what practice is done to actualize them, if we study that well, then when we hear different teachings or we learn different types of meditation, we'll know where in the path it fits. Okay? So the way to practice this path is to have this broad understanding of the whole path, and to cycle through all the different stages, all the different meditations that I've described so far, really doing them, you know, thoroughly, but emphasizing the ones at the level that we're at the present. So if we're somebody who our main practice needs to be subduing the 8 worldly concerns, then we're going to emphasize the first level, the initial level of practice. If we're somebody who, you know, automatically, you know, thinks more about future lives than about present lives, yeah, and we're generating the renunciation of all of the samsara, then we're going to go through all the meditations, but we're going to focus mostly on the ones concerning the middle level. Yeah, if we've gotten those first 2 levels down pretty well, and we're now really thinking, how can I be of the most effective benefit to all living beings in the long term, then we're going to focus, we'll do all of the meditations, but focus on the last ones. Okay? So, let's say somebody comes and teaches you about love, how to cultivate love and compassion. Where on the path does that go? Which level of being? Which one? The first one? Okay. It technically belongs to the 3rd one, okay, because we want to develop love and compassion for all beings, you know, to generate the bodhicitta. But it also applies to the 1st one, because the more we develop love and compassion, the better we're going to keep ethical conduct, because we'll stop harming others. Okay, do you see the link between developing love for others and stopping harming them on the 1st level? But then really perfecting our love so that we cherish others more than ourselves, that's going to come on the 3rd level. Okay? If somebody comes and teaches about how to develop concentration, where does that go? Okay, it goes on the 2nd level, because it's one of the 3 higher trainings. It also goes on the 3rd level, because it's one of the paramitas. Okay, so it actually goes on both, because whether you become an arhat or whether you become a Buddha, you need concentration. Okay. What about if somebody comes and teaches you about making prostrations and doing the repentance ceremony. Where does that go? Yeah, it goes on the first level. Yeah, because it pertains to keeping karma and its effects, purifying negative karma. Okay. If somebody comes and teaches you chanting Namo Amitofo, where does that go? This one's kind of a trick question. Depending on how you do the Amitabha practice, it can be on any of the three levels. So for example, if you're doing the Amitabha practice and you're visualizing Amitabha and light flowing into you and you develop regret for your negative actions, you develop a determination not to do them again, you take refuge in the three jewels and develop the bodhicitta for whoever you harmed, then doing that visualization of the light coming from Amitabha into you, you think that it's purifying all your negative karma. So when you meditate on Amitabha like that, it applies to which level? First level. Okay. Let's say you're meditating on Amitabha and you're really focusing on the visualization of Amitabha in the space in front of you. Yeah, you're going over the details of what Amitabha Buddha looks like, and then you're focusing your mind with very strong mindfulness on that image of Amitabha. Yeah, and really holding that in your mind. What kind of practice is that? Okay, that's two and three, because it's the practice of concentration. Okay, if you do the practice of concentration with the motivation to attain liberation, then it's two. If you do the practice of concentration with the motivation of becoming a Buddha, it becomes three. When you're meditating on Amitabha, which motivation are you supposed to cultivate? The one to be free of samsara, or the one to become a Buddha to benefit all beings? Which motivation does Amitabha Buddha want you to cultivate? Which motivation did Amitabha himself cultivate? Two or three? Some are saying two, some are saying three. If Amitabha cultivated two, the determination to be free of his own samsara, and left it at that, would he have become a Buddha? No. He would have become an arhat, and he would still be in his meditative equipoise in nirvana. Amitabha cultivated the bodhicitta and became a fully awakened Buddha. Which motivation do you think he wants us to cultivate? The third one. Okay. Yeah. So really, if we're doing Amitabha Buddha practice properly, it's not just so that we can have a good rebirth. It's not just so that we can get out of samsara. It's so that we can become a fully awakened Buddha with the same qualities as Amitabha, so that we can be of the greatest benefit to sentient beings. Okay? So you have to remember that. Otherwise, you're chanting, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha, Namo Kwan Shi Yin Busa. Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Namo Amitabha, Namo Amitabha. Okay. Is that practicing Amitofo? Are you going to get to the Pure Land like that? Okay. Because your motivation is missing. Your concentration is missing. Your sincerity is missing. Okay? Yeah. If you chant a million Amitofos and then you go out and you lie to people, are you going to get to the Pure Land that way? Yeah. You chant lots of Amitofos and then you go out and sleep with somebody else's husband and wife? That going to get you to the Pure Land? Forget it. Yeah? Okay? So it's very important if you aspire for the Pure Land to practice ethical conduct, to practice concentration, to practice bodhicitta, and to generate wisdom. If somebody comes and teaches you breathing meditation, which level of the path is it? Some people are saying one. Who's saying one? Who's saying two? Who's saying three? You're all right. Because again, it's depending on your motivation. Okay? If you're watching your breath simply to calm your mind, yeah, and just get the wrinkles out of your mind, you know, so that you're calmer during the day, then it's going to be one. If you're watching your breath in order to develop samadhi, it's going to, you know, and your motivation in developing samadhi is to get out of cyclic existence, it's going to be two. If you do it with the motivation to develop samadhi and, of course, develop the wisdom that you need, it's going to be three. Okay? What about somebody teaching you the four mindfulnesses, the four establishments of mindfulness, of body, feelings, mind, and phenomena. Where's that go? Where does that going go? Okay. Yeah. It'll go either with three or with two or with three. Again, depending on your motivation. If you're doing it to attain liberation, the four establishments of mindfulness are two. If you're doing it to, you know, become a Buddha, it's going to be three. Because in both cases, those are geared at helping us develop wisdom. And what is going to determine with that, once we have that wisdom, whether we become an arhat or a Buddha, is what we aspire for. Okay? So is this clarifying things for you a little bit? Or is it making you more confused? In other words, am I a success or am I a failure? Okay. So if you really think about this, it will help you a lot. Yeah, to really check your motivation and to really see where different practices belong. Yeah. You'll notice that ethical conduct comes in all three. Yeah? Ethical conduct comes in the first one in terms of abandoning the 10 non-virtues and creating the 10 virtues. It comes in the second one as part of the three higher trainings. It comes in the third as part of the bodhisattva precepts. Okay? So no matter what you practice, you need ethical conduct. Okay. So, we have a little bit of time for questions, maybe some answers. Who's attached to their reputation and that's not the reason why you're not asking questions? Are you afraid of asking a question? Because what are other people going to think about me? Maybe this is a dumb question. Oh no, they're going to think I'm dumb. The world's going to end. Chances are, if you have a question, somebody else has it, and they'll appreciate your asking it. Yes.
I want to ask some question, but I would rather use Indonesian because my English is not so fluent. Ini kok, sebelumnya yang aku tahu itu kan kalau seseorang udah jadi arahat, itu tuh sepenuhnya lenyap, disappear dari dunia ini.
So what previously what I know is if someone attain arahatship, he or she completely disappear from this life.
Yeah,
in a point, in a sense.
Get out of psychic existence. But recently, I found that another source tells me that someday the Buddha can wake that person to, hey, still there are another sentient beings to help. This is quite new for me. So my question is, does an arahant really disappear, or it still has a kind of everlasting mental continuum, or someday can it manifest into this world again to become a bodhisattva? Or because previously I just know that arahant is bye bye like that. Oh iya.
Kamu aja lah.
Ya jadi dulu sebelumnya aku pikir tuh yang aku tahu kalau orang udah jadi arahat itu sepenuhnya udah keluar dari ini samsara. Tapi belum lama ini aku dapat sumber lain, aku baca setelah dia jadi arahat. Suatu hari Sang Buddha bisa manggil dia untuk nolong yang lain. Jadi yang aku tanyain itu apakah arhat itu benar-benar udah keluar dari lingkaran samsara ini atau dia masih semacam apa ya? Semacam mental continuum apa ya, Pak?
Kesadarannya masih berlanjut apa tidak?
Oh iya, ha. Kesadarannya masih berlanjut atau enggak sampai bisa dipanggil sama Sang Buddha sampai suruh norong apa makhluk-makhluk yang lain gitu.
So this is a difference between there's a difference here between what the Pali tradition says and what the Sanskrit tradition says about this. Actually, in the Pali tradition, it's not very clear what happens when you become an arhat. The Buddha never really specified it in a really clear, concrete way, aside from saying it's the cessation of dukkha and the causes of dukkha. What some people who follow the Pali tradition say is that when an arhat ceases ignorance, anger, and attachment, then they cease all dukkha. Yeah. So when they're still alive, they have, you know, no ignorance, anger, and attachment. But they still have this body, which is a body of dukkha, because that's the body they took when they were born. But when they die, they no longer have the remainder of this body. So then they have what's called nirvana without remainder, meaning that the polluted aggregates, the body and mind that they took under the influence of ignorance, anger, and attachment at the beginning of that life have ceased. So some people say if, you know, your polluted body and mind cease, then there's no continuity of consciousness at all, and you kind of disappear into nirvana. Okay? From the viewpoint of the Sanskrit tradition, they say that the basic nature of the mind is pure. You can cease the ignorance, anger, and attachment, the afflictions, and the polluted karma, without ceasing the continuity of the mind. Okay? Because the afflictions have not entered into the nature of their mind, of the mind. They're like something painted on top of it. So you remove the afflictions and the pure mind remains. So in the Sanskrit tradition, they say that an arhat does not cease when they leave, when they die from this body, but they go into a state of nirvana where they're meditating on the ultimate nature of reality. And they stay in that meditation for a really long time because it's really blissful, until one of the Buddhas comes and wakes them up and says, it's very nice that you've attained liberation, but what about all the other sentient beings? And at that point, then those arhats start at the beginning of the bodhisattva path, and they go through the bodhisattva path and attain full awakening. So they eventually become Buddhas. Okay, so that's the teaching that says there's one final vehicle. In other words, that eventually everybody will attain Buddhahood. Okay? So the two traditions, Pali and Sanskrit, have different versions. I go with the Sanskrit one. Okay, it makes much more sense to me. Anything else? Yeah.
Can I ask about attachment? Uh-huh. Yeah. What if we get attached to the Dharma? I mean, we are going to be practicing, but we're also going to get attached. And how to notice that and how to counteract that? Thank you.
Okay, this question comes up a lot because people get confused between attachment and virtuous desire. Okay, there's two kinds of desire. One kind of desire is attachment. I want this, I want that, for, you know, money, possessions, good looks, social status. That's all attachment. But just because you like something, just because you think it's good, doesn't mean you're attached to it. Because to have attachment, you have to exaggerate the good qualities of someone or something. You know, if you're attached to your boyfriend or girlfriend, you're exaggerating their good qualities. They really aren't perfect. Sorry. You know, they aren't. So if you think they're perfect, there's exaggeration and you get attached based on that exaggeration. When you look at the Dharma, you see its good qualities, but you're not exaggerating its good qualities. Yeah, you're seeing the good qualities that are there. You're wanting to follow the path that leads you to a liberation and awakening. That's not attachment. That's a positive aspiration, a positive form of desire. That's something that we should want to do. Because otherwise, if you say that liking anything or preferring anything at all is attachment, then what we're left with is the ideal Buddha, or the ideal Buddhist just sits there and goes, duh, I don't want anything, because anything is attachment. So I don't want enlightenment, I don't want sentient beings to be happy, I don't want anything. Duh. Yeah. Is that what the Buddha did when he attained enlightenment? He sat like a bump on a log and went, duh. No. The Buddha knew exactly what he wanted to do. And he did it. Okay? So that clarity of purpose, clarity of mind, good, solid priorities, that's not attachment. That's wisdom. Okay? Attachment is when you go, oh, you know, my boyfriend, he's so wonderful, more wonderful than the Buddha. You know? Or you think, actually, he is the Buddha. He's Buddha boy. Yeah? Yeah. Buddha came on a white horse like Prince Charming, finally. You know, that's attachment. Okay? Or maybe Princess Charming. Yeah. Okay? That's attachment. Okay. There's somebody with a question back there. This will be our last question. Way in the back.
Namo Buddhaya, Venerable. Saya mau tolong tanya. Saya pernah dapat BBM gitu ya. Pernah baca itu mengenai arahat. Jadi salah satu biksu, dia ditulis tahun 2400 sekian akan mencapai arahat. Pertanyaan saya, itu memangnya bisa gitu diramal apa gimana gitu ya? Saya aneh gitu, maksudnya bacanya tuh ras kok aneh gitu loh.
2400 sekian.
Iya, 2400 kan sekarang masih 2015.
So,
nah dia tulisnya gitu.
You know, with our smartphone we have this BlackBerry Messenger. And once she received a BlackBerry broadcast message saying that someone is going to be an arhat sometime in 2400 in the future. So I'm getting confused. Would that possible that an arahanship is predicted?
I suppose so. But I wouldn't necessarily believe everything that's written in a BlackBerry message. As His Holiness the Dalai Lama says, we never really know the future until it happens. Okay, so let's dedicate. Oh, you have something quick? Okay.
Oke, jadi bagaimana mempraktekkan tiap tingkat itu dengan sebaik-baiknya, ya. Lalu untuk tingkat 2 dan 3 bisa nggak dicapai dengan sebagai umat awam? Ya?
So the first question about how to practice, there's what's recommended to do is there are some short prayers, you know, that go through all the steps that we've talked about. And it's good to recite one of them every day because it reminds you of all the different steps. So one of those prayers is the 37 practices of bodhisattvas, which is translated into Bahasa, Indonesian, isn't it? Yeah. And so, you know, reading that is quite good. There's several other prayers. I don't know if they're translated, but that I know that one is. And then what's good to do is stop each day, and you read the whole thing so you get the whole perspective, but each day, in order, meditate on each verse, okay? And by meditation, I mean these kinds of checking meditation, like Venerable Samten's going to be leading you in, okay? Then your second question, yes, you can attain either arhatship or Buddhahood as a lay person. I think it's easier as a monastic, but it's definitely possible as a layperson. Okay? Okay, so let's do the two dedication verses, and then the three verses to offer the food, which are the last three verses of the food offering prayer.
Okay. Ya, kita baca doa dedikasi bersama-sama, lalu bait atau ayat persembahan makanan, tiga ayat terakhirnya ya. Semoga berkat kebajikan ini kita semua segera mencapai kondisi pencerahan Guru Buddha, sehingga kita mampu untuk membebaskan semua makhluk dari penderitaan. Semoga pikiran bodhi yang maha berharga yang belum muncul dan berkembang, semoga yang sudah ada tidak berkurang, melainkan semakin bertambah. Kepada Guru Agung Buddha yang maha mulia, kepada perlindungan agung, halaman 16 sudah. Kepada Guru Agung Buddha yang maha mulia, kepada perlindungan agung Dharma yang maha mulia, kepada para pembimbing agung Sangha yang maha mulia, aku memberikan persembahan kepada semua objek perlindungan. Semua kita dan semua di sekeliling kita tidak pernah terpisahkan dari tiga permata di dalam setiap kehidupan. Semoga kita senantiasa berkesempatan untuk memberikan persembahan kepada mereka, dan semoga kita terus menerima berkah dan inspirasi dari mereka untuk selalu maju di jalan pembebasan. Dengan melihat makanan ini sebagai obat, saya akan mengonsumsinya tanpa kemelekatan ataupun kebencian, atau untuk meningkatkan kesombongan, kekuatan atau keindahan saya, tetapi hanya demi untuk mempertahankan hidup.